billion people in the world. Not everyone's going to get this.
Great day, everyone. This is Gray Transforms. I am Travis Gray. Today we are transforming with yet another amazing guest, Eric Bell Sterling. Eric has been in the mental health field for over 25 years. Eric has a master's of transpersonal counseling psychology and is working towards a PhD in clinical sexology with an emphasis on addiction. Eric, we've just had a brief connection, and I feel really good about this conversation. I feel like really, just that we're a part of the same tribe. I really feel this. So, how are you today, Eric?
I'm doing great, Travis. Thank you for having me on the show. I'm humbled and delighted and a little nervous too.
Well, don't be nervous. We were already doing a great job. So we were talking about a variety of things, and I got a little look into your bio and your history. How did you fall into the transpersonal? How did you fall into this world of bringing spiritual principles into mental health, healing yourself, healing others? How did Eric's story start?
Sure. Well, first, I'm in long-term recovery from multiple addictions, and sex, porn, love, mainly one of many. And I got into my own recovery, started in 91. And then, the long and short is in 95, I went to a halfway house in, Mesa, Arizona. And then I started working with young at-risk adolescents, a lot of inner city kids from Phoenix, and got my teeth cut working with, young adolescents in gangs. And then I went and did wilderness therapy in Idaho and worked with kids out in the desert of Idaho and realized this is what I love to do. And then I went, at the time, there were only two schools. There was Naropa University and there was Prescott College in Prescott, Arizona, that were doing wilderness therapy, had a specialization in that. And I had a friend that was at Naropa, and he said, "Eric, I think you'd like this program. Check it out." And as soon as I saw the website, I knew I wanted to go to Naropa. I had already been doing meditation, and Naropa, is big on meditation. They were light years ahead of the curve with mindfulness. And, so I went there, and that started my journey on transpersonal psychology, which I really didn't know until I went to Naropa, because I went to Naropa more because of the meditation and the wilderness therapy component. So that started my journey. And then I graduated. I found the job here in Asheville, North Carolina, which is my hometown, and didn't even hear about, never knew of Asheville, landed the job here, came here, did wilderness therapy for a while, and then started private practice in 2014. I specialize in all addictive disorders, all substance, but mainly process addictions, and I'm known in my area for mainly sex, porn, and love, and anything that's problematic with sexual. It could be compulsive dating apps, compulsive escorts, compulsive cyber sex, compulsive pornography, you name it. That's my specialty. And of course I'm in my own recovery from this. So I got introduced to Patrick Carnes' work in 91. And Patrick Carnes is known for his seminal work around, he really named the issue of sex addiction. There's a lot of controversy around that term. I'm very aware. A lot of people don't like to call it that. A lot of controversy around whether it exists or not. I pride myself in, not only cognitive, but I'm constantly studying the tier one peer-reviewed research. And it's every bit of an addictive disorder as heroin, meth, you name it, gambling. I like to use gambling because that's the one that's been recognized as of the first process addiction that is now in the DSM-5. And it's only a matter of time before I think that we see that anything that releases dopamine can potentially cross that threshold from impulsive use to compulsive use, otherwise known as addiction. And, you know, I'm hesitant to use the word addiction because it's got this pejorative thing in society, because society doesn't like addicts. That's fine, whatever we call it, compulsive, you know. But the real word of addicted is to be enslaved, which is basically how I was with my addiction. So that was a long-winded way to answer your question. And of course, you know, transpersonal, a lot of people, I didn't know this till I went through Naropa, is that, you know, Abraham Maslow, who was one of the first transpersonal psychologists, and, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, the one that doesn't get mentioned a lot is that once we self-actualize, he believed, and I believe this too, that we're hotwired to transcend, to actually transcend Eric, personal Eric, I, and go into the we, or as Dan Siegel says, the mwe, M-W-E. So there's me and there's the we. And when we have the me and the we and we integrate it, it's mwe. And so that's, I have big juice around that. It excites me because we're in an age right now where either we're going to come together as human beings or we're not going to make it, you know? I'm going to pause there. Did I answer your question?
Yeah. No, you totally answered the question. That was so great. It's interesting. I'm seeing some of the mirroring aspects of my own professional career and development. I also worked with a population of adolescents. It is fascinating how you are, like, when I was growing up, I was in and out of jail quite a bit. So 17 to 21, I was in and out of jail about twice a year. I was subjected to outpatient treatment programs twice. I had to do the same 4-month outpatient program. Once was for the city, and then once was for the DMV. They didn't take the first round. The DMV didn't take that first round that I did. And so I ended up having to do it again because of the like complications in trying to get my driver's license back and a gambit of other things happening in that time. I was super angry at these programs. And that was when, at the time, I was 17, 18. And then coming back around as a clinician, holding space for these adolescents. I did programs with nonviolence programs, adolescents that were court mandated. They were on probation for domestic violence in a variety of ways. And so they were in a 6-month program, and it's just interesting how you heal a part of yourself by healing others. And to start off in that way with adolescents is really cool. So you had discovered Naropa and this nature focused program through a friend, and then now your focus is in the healing journey that you've been on, and connecting to addictions and sexology. I'm not exactly sure what is clinical sexology.
Sure. First, thanks for working with adolescents, man.
Yeah,
that's some of the hardest work there is. And anybody who can work with adolescents in my book can work with anybody.
Yeah,
because that is the toughest population, man. So thank you,
man, it really is the toughest population. At that time, I was supposed to be co-facilitating. It was supposed to be two facilitators, and then we had two groups a week. So it was like a Monday, Tuesday thing. It's supposed to be two facilitators, but one of the facilitators was not able. We were just low in providers. We were low in facilitators and trainee therapists at the time. And so I had one group of 8 young adolescent boys that did not want to be in this program by myself. I had to take notes on all 8 people. And it's just, really, really tough to do. But I was also able to connect with them a lot because I had a history as well. I'm sure that you've, in your addiction recovery, you have a better ability to connect with just the clients can believe that you can relate to them better. You know, they like that, and that's really important. That therapeutic relationship is so valuable, maybe the most valuable thing in that interaction in the healing environment and facilitation. So you're right. Working with adolescents is really challenging and just as rewarding.
Absolutely. I was just going to say that they're the energy that they provide. I have so much gratitude, and there's so much energy and imagination and ability to risk take and be authentic. It's a very special population in my heart. And I love that population. So anyway, so clinical sexology, your question, I better get this right, because my supervisors will have my rear end. So I'm just going to, it is a comprehensive program that includes diagnosis, treatment, and research of sexual dysfunction, sexual abuse treatment, legal, ethical, and forensic issues in sexuality, medical issues affecting sexual functioning, gender and orientation, alternative lifestyle and kink, and a whole lot more.
It's the clinical psychology of everything that is under the umbrella of sexual disorder, sexual queerness. And when I say queerness, I mean anything that is outside of like the neuronormative side of things, maybe.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And What got me interested in this field, Travis, is that I had been in recovery from sex, love, porn, compulsive porn, sex, love issues, and I started asking, what is healthy? Like, what is healthy? Like, we're not taught that. I wasn't taught that. Most young people in America are not taught that. 26 states currently are. Required, 13 of which are required to teach medically accurate sex education. And they don't even touch intimacy, nothing. It's mainly mechanics around how babies are born. That's sex education in America right now. So my point is that I never was taught healthy sexuality. So I started asking the question, what is healthy sexuality? And I started looking, and the more I looked, the more I was like, oh my God, the more I realized I don't know. And my friends don't know. Most people don't know. I sought out a school, because I wanted to learn what is healthy sexuality. And I'm still learning that, by the way. I'll be learning that probably to the day I die. And it's fascinating. Freud even said, I don't agree with a lot of Freud. I'm more of a Jungian, but he did have some things that were interesting. And he would say, you know, that sex is life force. It's life force energy. And it really is powerful energy. So I'm fascinated with this idea of what is healthy and according to who, which of course is as individuals are thumbprints, you know? And so I've been challenged to my core about my own sexuality, my own biases, being, you know, I'm white, privileged male, cisgender, hetero, and really have had to look at that, at my own biases and privilege. And I say that not to go into shame, which happened to me when I went through Naropa and I had to work that in therapy. And I realized, no, I just have privilege, and it's my responsibility to use that privilege in a good way. So I name that. And, but I have biases. I have a particular lens that I need to be aware of and keep in front of me at all times, especially when I'm working with in sexuality. And with different human beings. So, because what is healthy for me may not be healthy for my patients, or you know, that what's healthy for them may not be healthy for me. So it's just a very creative, interesting field that fires me up. It's good stuff. I love it. It motivates me. So yeah, that's the field of clinical sexology.
It fills your cup. You're intrigued by it. It's so deeply interwoven into your narrative, into your story. I really love this aspect of the eros, the sexual energy, the eros being so powerfully driving humanity, driving all things. It is the very masculine, feminine being woven together, is the energy that brings those two things together, is this eros that is interwoven everywhere. I really love this myth of eros and psyche. Do you know this one?
Yes. Yes.
That one's really good. There's a good book somewhere here about that myth, eros and psyche. And I think it's really fascinating how psyche is like our mind, our mental. I encourage the viewers, the listeners, I encourage you to check out this myth. There's a myth of eros. The main characters are Eros, Psyche, and Aphrodite. Aphrodite, the goddess of women, and then Eros is like Cupid, or this deity of sexual energy. And then Psyche is this beautiful woman that Aphrodite is jealous of. And Psyche is also, it's also the mind. It's the Maya. It's also this like unconscious to their own proclivities and unconscious to their kind of like a little ditzy in some ways, the way that I had interpreted the myth. But really fascinating story, a lot of wisdom there. But the power of Eros is really fascinating. It drives all kinds of things. It drives all kinds of creation. Why else would men create if it wasn't for, you know, this intimacy with others, this intimacy, like to show value, to attract the love and the external affirming of intimacy that earlier we were speaking about the foundation of intimacy in addictions. Can you say a little bit more about that?
First, I agree with you around that Eros energy. And we were talking earlier, you know, and I believe I expressed to you that I really feel all addictions are an intimacy disorder. And where it's an intimacy, you know, the word intimacy, it comes from Latin intimus, which is into, innermost. And I believe that I was indoctrinated to believe that it's outside of here. It's not inside. And of course, in my own journey in recovery, you know, I've had, you know, this idea of recovery. Well, what am I trying to recover? Trying to recover authentic Eric, right? Who is he? And then if you do IFS, which I do, internal family systems, we have all these parts. Who are my parts? And, you know, what are the needs and wants of my parts? How do I differentiate a need and a want? How do I ask appropriately for a need and want? And then the really hard work is, believe me, I'm worth letting it in, because I'm probably going to get it if I ask. It's been my experience. But the point is that all these skills are inside. It's an inside job. And I was indoctrinated to believe it's outside. The shiny object, the booby prize is out here. You know, when I get the car, the woman, the prestige, the power, the money, I'm going to be okay. And that's just a setup for a world-class train wreck. It does not happen. And it's only when I've been internal. And, you know, you mentioned something interesting earlier in my recovery, I took a period of celibacy. Whole year where I did not masturbate. I didn't orgasm. Now, some would say that's an extreme measure. For me, what that allowed me to do is go inside my own heart and soul with great diligence and find out who really am I? What are my parts? What are my values? Who do I want to be in relation to this, in this human form? And that was creative energy. And I had a lot of energy. I couldn't sleep for like a week. And that's where I started to read and journal. I had just a boatload of energy when I sublimated my eros into learning and discovered a whole new world. And it was creative energy. It's beautiful energy. So, and of course, I'm not saying that you give up that, because in the recovery process from sexual addiction, it leads to be, it's a lot like an eating disorder where the goal is not to give up food. The goal is not to give up our sexuality. The goal is to develop a healthy relationship to my sexuality, my food. And what is ego syntonic for Eric, and then go with it, right? So, and that changes over time. But that process it started internally. So I think in my heart, I believe that we live in this world right now. And I shared with you, I just got back from listening to Dr. Anna Lemke, who wrote Dopamine Nation. I saw her speak. She's a beautiful, beautiful person, beautiful soul, a very intelligent, wise woman. And she said, this is the first time in our species history where we were hotwired to be in fight, flight, freeze, and to what Stephen Porges calls neuroception, constantly looking for danger. We don't have to do that now. So there's a lot of boredom, and we're being bombarded by so much stimulus at a rate that we've never seen before, that any human's nervous system now is subject to being hijacked and going into an addictive process and disconnecting us from our authentic selves. And so she believes, and I believe it too, is taking time out from social media. And we're not going to get rid of technology. It's how do we adapt now? How do we adapt to it? And how do I become a responsible digital citizen and keep myself, my homeostatic or my hedonic set point even? But the bottom line in all this, Travis, is what I'm trying to say is that if I'm not mindful and careful, I can be hijacked into thinking intimacy's outside of me. And it's really inside. It's an inside job. And then it echoes outside and becomes a positive or a dynamic feedback loop. But I was believed that it was outside of me at first, and I searched that, and that was a black hole. It doesn't work. And I see that. I mean, that's what I deal with on every day in my life, in my clients, and trying to help them to see, you know, first, what are they trying to recover? Because Patrick Carn said this to me one time, and it sticks with me to this day, and I use it. He goes, if I say no to something, i.e. porn, sex, drugs, whatever, of social media, I better know what I'm saying yes to. What's the yes? Who do I want to be in this planet? Who's Eric? What are my parts? How do I want to contribute my gifts? What kind of legacy do I want to leave? You know, that's the yes. And that's going to get me through some hard times, because it's hard to give up, because the addiction, which aren't bad parts, they're just maladaptive coping mechanisms. I don't like that word defective character. I think that's a horrible name. It's a toxically based word. My addiction was a maladaptive coping mechanism, and it worked. It worked really well. It got me through some really hard times till it about killed me. And then I had to say, okay, this isn't working. And thank goodness I had good therapists, good mentors who didn't who didn't shame me, because I was already shame-based. I already felt like I was not okay as a human being, who said, no, that's a maladaptive skill. And it's not a bad part. It's just part of your makeup. And when I learned to treat that part with curiosity and compassion, which was really hard because I was used to fire and brimstone. So, you know, Ernie Larson says, what we live with, we learn. What we learn, we practice. What we practice, we become. So I was practicing the same thing that was taught to me, which is, you shithead, you know, you bad person. Well, that doesn't work. So I had to say, oh, I see you, buddy. Come on and have a cup of tea with me. And then once I got to know that part, I asked it, what are you afraid will happen if you can't do your job? Oh, you're worthless. Oh, you're gonna die alone. Oh, you're gonna be abandoned. And then I had to deal with that and really look and realize I'm not alone. That I had, when I was that authentic and vulnerable with my men friends, and I had to get this from men, not women, men who witnessed that in my process and honored that and gave me the father blessing that my dad couldn't give me. He tried, but he couldn't. And they witnessed that and they said, you're okay. Then I started believing, oh my God, I'm not a defect. I'm not this weirdo. I'm actually human. And then when I was praised for that, my sensitivity, which is I stifled and exiled because I it wasn't okay to do that as a man. I was looked at as a weak. That I realized that's my greatest gift, my sensitivity. And then I started, you know, that's flourished to today where it's like, oh man, you know, I want to spread this, you know, to other men. So I do a lot of work with men. That's my main clientele. I do and boys, adolescent men, male identified. Because as you know, gender is changing at a warp speed. So I'm very mindful to say male identified because there are some young people transitioning. And anyway, I don't want to get tangential there. I can do that. So
you're so good. I like, I'm a big fan of great tangents. I feel like it just, when you allow the mind to unfold and the beautiful ways that you were just doing. So you spoke about a lot of really important things, including just like the most specific thing was the answering the question on around intimacy. Is the intimacy is an inner journey. What did you say the Latin for intimacy was?
Intimus.
Intimus. So intimus, your innermost. Your innermost experience of yourself, that doesn't come from outside of you, but we do have, man, modern times, we do have this focus outside of ourselves, and maybe that's not unique to modern times. That's just history. That's just human life. Is that we think of the material world as this. This foremost important piece of existence, but maybe that is not where we're going to find the intimacy, and that's sort of like the, you know, that's a treasure trove of wisdom, is to find that the intimacy that we are seeking outside of ourselves is actually within ourselves. But then, you know, in modern times, we have such a focus on material existence, on material, you know, collecting material things, and whether that's cars and houses and money and women and things like this, as a man, or just like the collecting of relationships, or for a woman, like the collecting of a good man that has all of those things, you know, that already and possesses all of those things. And then you have like social media that is causing all of this fragmentation and fracturing of consciousness, so that we can't be our whole selves to take a look at the intimacy within us and kind of like you know, start to gauge and measure what are the important goals to us and our purpose and what kind of being do we want to be in this world, in this existence? How does this form that is Eric or that is Travis, how does this form actually want to be in the world? We don't have time, don't have like the capacity of the RAM to look at those things and derive like these like really, you know, tangible answers. We don't have really really concrete answers to some of those questions because our attention is so fragmented, it's so fractured and so externally focused. And so that's where a therapist comes in. That's where these practices of mindfulness and other things come in. I think it is really valuable for young men that are listening or just people in general listening, that your life does not need to like you know, in a month, if you ask somebody just randomly on the street, how many times should you be having sex in a month? You know, there's an answer. Like it seems like for a general majority of people, there would be an answer to that. There'd be like, oh, maybe two times or four times or eight times or like, you know, and the more influence indoctrinated they are to like the popular culture, the higher that number is. It feels like, oh, it's so important to have sex all the time. Like if I'm not having sex all the time, but it's so valuable for us to hold on and discover the value of holding on to our eros, our chi, or our sexual energy, how valuable it is to hold on to that and alchemize that and utilize that and the strength that we feel from sitting with that.
Absolutely. And you reminded me, you know, I can't tell you how many young men I work with who, now I may do a study around this, because when I mention that word intimacy, what do you think comes to mind, most young men's minds immediately? Intercourse, right? Yeah. Intercourse. And it just speaks to how the need for, because that, I mean, that's part of the reason I'm going for this PhD in sexology, is I want to teach young male identified. I just want to pose the question, do you think there's a difference between intimacy and intercourse? I mean, I wish I was posed that question as a young man. Just that question alone would have gotten my critical skill parts of my brain working like, huh, oh, there is a difference. Yeah, there is. There's a huge difference. I mean, there's 50 billion shades of gray. And so, you know, but again, I had no, ideally it comes from men older than me who question that in me and who are living that and embodying that. Cause, you know, I believe the best teachers, the best, they're my best healers, that they were living it. They were embodying their principles they were teaching. And I believe that. And I do my best to do that also. I don't always do it well, which is why I'm in my own therapy to this day, in my own peer supervision groups. But the piece here that, you know, it just strikes me that so many young men, and probably for women too, but I deal with men, they think of that intimacy equates with sex. And it really frightens me, but more it saddens me, because it's like, come on, we're failing our younger people. We're letting them miss out, because I believe in my heart that this cuts right to the core of how we treat each other as human beings. Because how I treat you is going to be, it's how I'm treating me and all my parts. So again, that's where the intimacy starts within me. I better have curiosity. You know, Dick Schwartz talks about the eight C's: curiosity, compassion, clarity, calmness, connectedness, creativity. I can't remember them all, but they're all beautiful adjectives, you know? And so that's internal. And the more I can do that with me, the more I'm going to do that with you and everybody, every other human being and sentient being I come in contact with. So again, that's the inside job that I think we're missing. And I want to teach that, you know? So,
yeah, so for those listening, how do you define intimacy? Can you bring intimacy, this word, into defining terms? What is intimacy?
Yeah. Oh gosh, that's really like trying to, what is love, you know? Sure. Well, according to who, you know, and then, well,
according to Eric Bellstring, Bellsterling, what is,
sure,
what is?
Well, I think it starts with identifying, hopefully first having some models that I'm getting good enough parenting. I have good enough attachment. I'm getting all my needs met, my basic needs met. So again, Maslow's hierarchy. I mean, and then that need, I'm getting love and things. And I think once all those needs are met, that we have the time, we're not being shot at or constantly looking for our next meal, that I can reflect and go within and get to know my parts, right? And I'm not naive to think that I've been privileged to have that time, to not be in fight, flight, freeze all the time, that I can start getting to know my parts. And the difference between a need and a want, which there are differences and they change. They've changed sometimes over a course of a day for me. But that distinction between a need and a want, I think, is really critical. For me, it's learning more about the difference between a microaggression, which again starts within myself, with my self-talk. We talked about Deepak Chopra earlier. I heard him speak one time and he says we have between 60,000 and 70,000 men, 60,000, 70,000 thoughts. Women have more because they have a bigger corpus callosum a day. So I better pay attention to my thoughts because that's energy. That's, as Dan Siegel would say, that's energy and information flow. And where attention goes, energy flows and neuronal growth grows. So my thoughts are laying down neural nets in my brain like a computer. So I'm paying attention to my thoughts. If I have a microaggression, oh, you're bad, Eric, you're a jerk. It's okay, buddy. Yep, you made a mistake. Do I owe a 10 step here? I apologize, man. I apologize. I was impatient there, right? And I'm a good guy. I'm a good guy. I'm a part of the human, right? So this is intimacy. And then also I believe in my heart that we get sick in tribe and we get well in tribe. So I need five guys in my tribe who can give me reality checks, who see my shadow or my exiled parts, which I, Eric, individual, can't see. They can see it. And that's a must for me in my recovery. And I have that. And through the Mankind Project, guys who aren't afraid to hold me accountable and say, Eric, you know, for example, so if I'm not showing up to my I group, integration group, and I made a commitment to be there twice a month, my guys will say, Eric, what's going on, man? You're right. Like you said, you're going to be here in 2 months. So my point is that accountability, and there's a mechanism that I can transform those shadow and exile parts into adaptive assets, right? Because those parts are not bad. They can be transformed. So this is all intimacy to me. These are all forms of intimacy. And as you can see, there's many layers of intimacy. And I'm not mentioning sex. Like, I'm not mentioning sex, like intercourse, right? And I always think that's an interesting term, sex, because it says, is this female or it's a phenotype? you know, like, and then, you know, anyway, I could go on that, but intercourse, right? No mention of intercourse there. And what are my preferences? Like, what do I, and then what are my gifts? What can I add to the planet? These are all different layers of intimacy, you know, to me. And, yeah. And believe it or not, even a big argument, I've been in the Mankind Project. We get some pretty bright, passionate men in there, and I've had some serious conflict, and I have a real conflict avoidant part. And I got to tell you, it's through the Mankind Project that I realized I was afraid of my own rage, and I have rage in me. And I got confronted by a man in the Mankind Project. He said, "Eric, have you ever looked at your inner killer?" "What do you mean?" "I went to Naropa. I don't have an inner killer." "Well, guess what? I have an inner killer and I have an inner rager. And I'm grateful I know that about me. But when I can keep that rage in front of me and that inner killer part, it can be transformed." And it's through the men in Mankind Project where I've had staunch, passionate disagreements, and that inner killer came out, but I didn't act on them, but I talked about them, and I did my best to stay in my body and keep myself in the window of tolerance, as Siegel would say. I've actually grown to trust those men more. And that blew my mind, because I was never modeled healthy anger or rage. I always saw my dad or mom rage, or they stuffed it. I never saw it handled in an assertive way. And it was through the men in the Mankind getting into these arguments that if I stayed in my body and stayed curious and open, I could grow and learn to trust and love these men more. That was wild. That blew me. So that's intimacy. That's a flavor of intimacy to me. And I remember you and I think you mentioned nonviolent communication. I don't know if you mentioned that, but I remember Marshall Rosenberg saying this, the inventor of nonviolent communication. He said, if two opposing enemies can get together and do their best to put themselves in another person's shoes or their enemy's shoes, they don't find the solution. The solution finds them. And I that sticks with me. And so these are all forms of intimacy for me, Travis. Yeah. You know,
that's great. So I'm like trying to figure out a way to like summarize the things that you said. You're pointing out really specific, very important things. One, maybe the most important thing is that intimacy and intercourse. Intimacy does not require intercourse. Intercourse is not the foundation of intimacy. The foundation of intimacy is innermost connection, as the word, as the Latin phrase. So that innermost connection. So how are you going to get that outside of yourself? Well, when it's in a tribe of men or in a tribe of people that are, you know, going through the same things, experiencing life in some of the same ways, then that experience of them, the intimacy that is received there, is from being heard and seen, and being heard and seen in that group, you know, in your even the things that you are trying not to look at yourself, like that inner rage and things like that. If somebody outside of you in that safe space can see that for you, help you see that yourself in a healthy manner, and sometimes that could come out in anger, that could come out in conflict, but resolving those conflicts in ways that are healthy, which is an art, a skill in itself. It's not easy to conflict resolve, but these are skills that can be learned. And a lot of the nonviolence programs that I did with adolescents was centered around conflict resolution skills. And so it is intimacy is to be heard, to be seen in your innermost self. And first, are you able to find some of that in yourself instead of looking or maybe being there was another aspect of this that is sometimes it's a need, sometimes it's a want. Like intimacy is always, I would say it's always a need. We all need some level of intimacy. And when we are in, you know, detrimental pain or isolation or some of those things, that is when we are really in need of some intimacy. Sometimes we want more intimacy than we already have. Maybe we want more intimacy with a partner, or we want more intimacy. So we want more to be heard, seen, held. And so that's why we need community. We're social beings. So there's sometimes need, want to be heard, to be seen, your innermost self. These are the aspects, the qualities that are the foundation for intimacy, not intercourse.
Correct. And we talk about in the sexology program that there's in the mainstream sexology program, there's 8 forms, and sex is just one of those 8. And I can't remember the 8 off the top of my head, but the gist of it is exactly what you just said, that there's so much more than intercourse in regard to intimacy. And you don't have to have intercourse to have intimacy. And they're not, they're just, you don't. And it's part of it if you'd like it, you know? So, it just is such an interesting, I think, rich area that we're not taught. Like it really starts within. And,
So intimacy, what I heard you say earlier was that intimacy is like an intimacy disorder is the catalyst to the addiction disorder.
I think all addictions, if you look at it, I'm visual, so I see things if the iceberg metaphor, it's the tip of the iceberg. The addiction is the tip of the iceberg. So that all the, it's masking something. It's usually pain. You know, Gabor Mate, he says, don't ask why the addiction, ask why the pain, because all addictions mask pain. So once we take away the addiction, get ready, the pain's going to come up. So the question is, why the pain? Oh, I'm afraid of being beaten, or I'm not okay. At some level, I'm not okay. So there's a core disconnect. I'm not okay. I mean, I don't think there's too many more. I mean, maybe, you know, pancreatic cancer saying, yeah, you're going to get pan. I mean, if somebody believes they're defective, like it's such a, because I don't believe that in my heart. I believe we're born these beautiful beings of light and we're sponges and we just soak up energy and. If you believe that you're not okay, it's horrible. So you want out of the pain. So we're going to do something, go to behavior or a substance to mask the pain. And, you know, so that's the core disconnect that keeps me from really, from the intimus, knowing my innermost self, right? And of course, the insidiousness is that these behaviors work. They do take away the pain or the substances. They do. They work, and they work really well. And some people will die. I've had 4-5 clients in my die because of fentanyl. And so, you know, it's that's the disconnect. So a lot of the work in recovery is, again, what am I trying to recover? Oh, this authentic Dick Schwartz talks about this. He calls it the self, right? And I like to say the authentic self, which is this core essence that we all have. If you're human, you have it. You're born with it. That is curious, compassionate, calm, clear, creative, connected. It's just beautiful energy. He calls those the 8 C's. And if I can get back to that and really cultivate that, I can start reparenting all these parts and realizing, and then realizing if I'm in with another group that's in recovery, I can start being vulnerable with them and realize I'm not alone. And I have other beings that believe that lie and now don't believe it and can help me on my path. And so I'm forming these positive feedback loops, and I get stronger and stronger. And that energy ripples. It just ripples. And hopefully we get people starting to ask themselves the question, how many parts do I have? What is the difference between a need and a want? How does that shift for me? How do I ask for that? You know, consent. So many, you know, me, I'm still learning consent. When do I ask permission? When do I not assume? I still catch myself assuming a lot. And I have to be like, no, I can't assume. Don't assume, Eric, you know? So, and then ask for it. And then for me, some of the hardest work was believing I'm worth letting it in, because I've gotten it. And there are parts of me that get really scared to let it in. And, the one thing I will share with this is hard. This finding this intimacy and reclaiming my authentic, intimate Eric self, I couldn't do it alone. I have to have a tribe. I have to have a network. I have to have people I know love me and love me enough that they will be honest with me and tell me when my shadow or exile parts are out. And that's the only way I've been able to do that. Okay. And that's an ongoing process. And, I think I shared with you earlier, I think to be a therapist, to be a good therapist, I better be in my own therapy because I will be till the day I do leave this profession, because, and or a very good peer supervision group, we have a mechanism to look at countertransference and transference, because it cannot not come out in the session. It's going to come out, and I better be aware of those parts when they come out, and I better be aware of my liabilities. And I have limits. There are some people I don't want to work with, and that helps them and me. So, but because the work's too complex. And so
what I am hearing you emphasize is the value of community, the value of, we are social beings, and we need other people around us that love us enough to also let us know what our shadows are that are coming up. In the therapeutic context, a lot of the viewers are probably transpersonal psychologists or therapists, and so it is so important to have your peer group, or is so important to have to be walking the walk. If you're a therapist and you are not, and maybe you're a facilitator, you're like holding space for all of these different practices, mindfulness, and you're telling them, oh, they should exercise. Exercise is really important for your well-being, for your mental health and your well-being. But then you yourself are not exercising, or you yourself are not meditating. You yourself are not in therapy. You yourself are not doing some of those things that you are encouraging and knowing is so valuable for these clients. It's important that the therapists are also encouraged to find the things that are going to work for them in the same way as that they are offering this support to their clients. And man, it is so. Recently, I did have the opportunity to be in a men's group. I was in a men's group for maybe 3 days. We had 3 days of different activities. It was like a small taste of what the men's work was like. And it was phenomenal. It was really great, really important for me. My father passed away when I was 18 months old. So I didn't really have this father figure growing up. And it was so important to have that seen and heard by other men, to have my shadows or my aggression to have a healthy place to express my aggression and not be shamed for it, or to speak about things that in ordinary context in the outside world, I might be shamed for it, but inside that safe container, I can be held. I can be seen and heard for all of those things. So valuable. And then to see other men also experiencing the healing of this environment is like, it's just healing on top of healing, and it's really great. So I want to get into this aspect as well. We've touched on it a little bit, and earlier you had spoke about the maladaptive skills or maladaptive behaviors, addiction as a maladaptive behavior. So it is something that the viewers, listeners will have experienced in their lives, is that they are going to a behavior, a habit, an addiction. They're going to this substance or this activity. They are doing this as a way to maybe get away from something else or heal, or it is masking an emotion, or somehow it is working for them. It is a behavior. It is a habit. It is working for them. It's a skill that is working for them in one context, but then in the whole of their lives, in the whole of their story, maybe it's not working for the whole of their story. Maybe that addiction is also while it's helping you get away from, you know, maybe a bad relationship or a bad job, it's also tearing down your healthy relationships and your healthy occupation, your healthy aspects as well. That maladaptive behavior is still doing some harm in some way. And that's how, for those that don't know, in the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, the DSM, that is like the foundation of any mental disorder, any addiction, is it interfering with your everyday life? Is it interfering with the way that you are wanting to live your life? If it is interfering with something that you're wanting to do or responsible for doing, and that is causing you to like spend all of your money on gambling when you know that you should be spending it on your bills, well, then now that is an addiction, that is disorder. And so so all of those maladaptive behaviors, I want to ask about. I think that there is a disorder of attention in the world today, and it's more and more prevalent all the time. And this disorder of attention, I think we're seeing it when the pathological paradigm, the pathological model, the mainstream way of dealing with mental health, when this approval or this permission to diagnose people with attention deficit disorder, now it's looking at anybody's level of attention deficit has become something worthy of diagnosing as a disorder, and then that becomes a label and becomes a box. It becomes a rigid set of standards, a rigid set of criteria that you are now identified with, and this is you. You are now, you have this attention deficit disorder. But it seems like more and more everyone is having this. There's this really intense addiction crisis or attention crisis, and that is. It seems like the foundation of that is addiction. It's addiction to social media. It's addiction to television. It's addiction to sex. It's addiction to just like a variety of things that is not not allowing a person to have the wholeness of attention to organize themselves into the wholeness of what they are intending on being. And so their fullest expression is unable to come out because they are addicted to the very things that are causing their attention to be fractured and fragmented and broken down. So it's a maladaptive behavior. Abraham Maslow. Again, you have mentioned Abraham Maslow a few times, so that Maslow's hierarchy of needs, intimacy is not the bottom of that. The bottom of that is like food, water, shelter. Intimacy is like somewhere a little bit above those things, and then self-actualization, but then transcending of that, like your fullest expression requires that whole Maslow's hierarchy to be met. But Maslow also spoke about other authors was repression of the sublime, but Maslow spoke about Jonah syndrome that I really like a lot. I reference a lot. So Jonah syndrome, the idea that you are running away from your fullest expression. And that's what we were doing in addictions. I could have this really healthy relationship with people or substances or a healthy relationship with maybe different things. And I don't, because I'm afraid of what that means. I'm afraid of the power of having a true intimate relationship that is not based in just the sexual interaction, that just the intercourse with that other person. So what do we do about this addiction to social media? And earlier you said like it's good to take breaks from social media and things, but we're in a technological society and place in life, and AI, all these things are being developed more. The algorithms for like Instagram or the algorithms for some of these social media or internet things, for men is so sex driven. It's so driven for you to be looking at, you know, models in bikinis and stuff like this. And like you're just overloaded by this sensory input of all of that. What do we really do?
Yeah. Well, you said a lot there. And a couple things come to mind. I think of, first starts with awareness, right? Being aware, because, I mean, you're right. We're not getting rid of technology. It's here forever. And AI is coming along, which adds another whole, that's another talk. And, you know, how can I be aware, right? So the other piece, addiction, this is an important distinction in that you'll see this throughout every single addictive disorder, and it's continuing to use the substance or do the behavior despite it causing me ego dystonic or what they pathological. It's taking away from my life. It's interfering with my relationships, work, hobbies, family, most intimate related. It's drawing away. So that's important. And a lot of people who really don't understand the neurochemistry of addiction, Nora Volkow, who was the head of NIDA, brilliant woman. She and Rita Goldstein, the iRISA, which basically means what happens is if you're using the hand model, the prefrontal cortex goes offline. So our ability to choose volition is really impaired in true addiction. Okay. The good news is the brain heals. And I can't use that as an excuse anymore. I have choice. I have agency because our brains heal, and that's great. You mentioned another thing about the Jonas effect with Maslow, which I'm not familiar with, but I can relate to it in that one of the biggest things, you're right, is scary. Intimacy is scary business. It's very, and I have to name that. I have to be safe enough to name that with people that I'm scared to do this. And the more I peeled away that onion for me, and this may look different for you or your viewers, other viewers, is that what it meant was, you know, that that quote by Marianne Williamson, she helped Nelson Mandela. My greatest fear is that I'm not powerless, or my greatest fear is that I'm powerful beyond measure, right?
My I think favorite
maybe quote. Screwed that quote up, but you get the gist. Both are true for me. I'm scared of my powerlessness. I'm scared of my power. And the reason I'm scared of my power, and this is just for me, but I invite you to, you know, viewers to ask themselves this, is that I have nobody else to blame then. I have to take total responsibility for every facet of my life, which is scary. It's scary. I have nobody to blame anymore. I'm responsible for everything, you know, and that's tough. That's tough to get my head around when I'm used to blaming others, or, you know, I have this belief or this script that I'm not okay or I'm defective. You know, and you mentioned the DSM, man. I mean, I'm a big Dan Siegel fan, and I love that guy. I like him as much as Wilbur, maybe more because he is actual clinician. But he went through the whole DSM-5, and I'm visual as hell. So he this made a lot of sense to me. He said he's a systems theorist, and he says all complex systems, which all human beings are, when they become disintegrated, they go to either extreme rigidity or extreme chaos, right? And every single disorder in the DSM is either extreme rigidity or extreme chaos, or both. And that made a lot of sense to me. And it's like, man, we all have, I mean, I can relate to, I have narcissistic traits. I have dependent personality traits. I have antisocial traits, parts. I mean, I've got them all, man. And it's like, how do I keep these parts in the middle of the river? He calls it the river of integration. And, you know, personally, I mean, none of it's based on empirical, studies. It's all anecdotal. From DSM-3 on. So it's basically for insurances. And, you know, hey, we need utility. We need some taxonomy to how to talk to each other as clinicians. But I don't give it a lot of, I look at wounding. I look at how people have been wounded, and to be human is to be wounded. We get wounded, man. It's part of this human existence. And then how do I transform that wounding and these, you know, traumas into abuses, neglect, into lemonade smoothie and a bouquet of miracles. It just takes awareness. You know, so you know your question is really a great one. Is like, I agree with you. We have an attention pandemic, and you know, I often think to myself, like, what if we all, like, just said time out and let's put a pause on, like, having no more kids. Like, let's really create a sustainable paradigm that we can thrive and everybody can eat and everybody can live to their potential. Like, what if we did that collectively? If we all focused our attention for like a week, that we're going to take a time out as a species and really see how we can come together. I mean, that would just even that thought gets me goosebumps. But, you know, we have all this stimulus coming at us. But again, it takes guys like you and me, these little songs. I have to do it. It starts with me. I've got to take a time out. You know, Anna Lemke, she's inspired me. She, every other week, she takes a time out from social media. I've been starting to do that. And it's hard. It's hard to do that because I'm used to picking this up and, you know, and this is the piece too. She says dopamine. We get a dopamine squirt. Every time we get the little ping, it's a hit. The thing we don't get, though, is every time we have a spike of dopamine, we have an opposite reaction where there's pain. And again, I have to meet that pain with pain. And she talks a lot about physical exercise to get through that withdrawal. And now for me, that's been the greatest, one of the greatest gifts of exercises is it keeps me, and it levels my dopamine. so that I can get through the craving when I take a time out from this, and I can focus my attention on other areas, you know? So it starts with me, though. I've got to be that model to counteract that attention deficit, you know, of looking for the shiny object outside of me. Yeah. And because it doesn't work.
Yeah. It puts such a tremendous emphasis on the value of intimacy. If I look inward and have a good deep relationship with myself, then that may be what is necessary. That is maybe what the solution that might be the healing that I am looking for, so that I am more responsible over my addictions, and if I'm more responsible over my choices, and not like it's like you can't blame social media that you're on social media. It's not social media did not like you made this choice to go there. And it was a hard choice not to make, because everyone else is making that choice all the time. But there are things that can be done for you to find some value in yourself that is not attached to the external stimuli of social media or some of the other things that we were talking about, sex and addiction and things like this. So this is all extremely valuable for people to recognize, and I love this real emphasis on intimacy. So I have another question for you. So in a bio that I was reading, it was like you were saying that universal spiritual principles was foundational, necessary for long-term recovery of addictions. So maybe that even ties into how valuable the transpersonal or the transcendence or the actualization of all of these things. And in that Marianne Williamson quote, that is my favorite quote by Marianne Williamson. I have a tattoo that represents that same quote from 10 years ago. So our greatest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our greatest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. Your playing small does not serve the world. It's the whole quote. I want to save the viewers, save the listeners from all that. The possibility that through intimacy, you could find the solution to your lack of agency or your lack of employing agency and volition and your decision, and heal your very brain from the constant dips in dopamine. You might have that little spike, but it almost seems like social media, I'll have that little spike of dopamine. And you're getting a little spike probably every time you look at another profile. You know, you look at one post, one profile, that gives you a spike. A new profile in your everyday life without technology, it would be like seeing a new person. It'd be meeting a new person, and there's a whole story behind them. There's all kinds of things, and so you're getting that little spike, the interest that is happening, the compounding interest of the little dopamine spikes is a compounding interest in negative experience and like a negative spike. So now those every little spike you're getting, you're starting to get more and more negative spikes. And so all of that is like you know, the antidote is the intimacy, but the universal spiritual principles is like the transcendence, the transpersonal experience, so that you can find that intimacy. It's like through the transcendent, you experience the intimacy, you know, maybe finally, maybe you have this spiritual experience and you're finally feeling the intimacy is coming from inside and not external. You know, is that some of the antidote for social media is kind of a part of the, this tangent and this curiosity, this inquiry that I'm doing out loud here. But what are the universal spiritual principles? What are the foundations of long-term recovery from all sorts of ways that addiction can manifest in our lives?
You know, we both have mentioned Deepak Chopra, who I really believe is a genius and a brilliant man and a mentor. And he said, I heard him say this one time and it stuck with me. And he goes, in the word spiritual is the word ritual. And so all my addictions were rituals. And in recovery, I had to learn healthy ritual. And I believe rituals are spiritual. And it could be as simple as eating a nutritious meal, which I believe is a spiritual act. Because what I eat is actually creating cells in my body. So I'm very mindful when I eat. I believe in that. It's energy. It's going into me. It's creating cells. But my point is that, you know, it in the early days of Carl Jung, who helped Bill Wilson and, a guy named Roland, who took it to Ebby Thatcher. Ebby took it to Bill Wilson. He said it takes a spiritual solution to recover from, you know, the spirits of alcoholism. And he wrote a famous paper. He goes, spiritus contra spiritum, which means that it takes a spiritual solution to conquer the spirits of alcohol. So what may be spiritual for me may look different for you. I tell my patient, they got to find what is spiritual for them. For me, concepts such as being as honest as I can with myself, right? Which I'll be doing the rest of my life. I still catch myself saying stupid little meaningless lies, which I pick up more in my body. And I'm like, why did I do that? It's gotten a lot better. But honesty, openness, open-minded, keeping my mind open, right? Like, that's interesting. Staying curious. As curious as I can, which is, you know, open-minded, willing to stay open, you know, sometimes just being willing to be willing. And that I may be off, you know, I don't see this right. You know, I don't see this, you know, see it in one way, my way, that's it. There could be other ways. Integrity, being trying to do my best to be congruent with what I think, feel, say, and do. And if I don't, accountability, right? I'm sorry. I messed up there. You know, that there's accountability. There's responsibility that I learned to have agency for myself, that I am responsible. I really am. Like I, you know, as scary as that was for me, it also was incredibly empowering to realize I'm steering the ship, you know. Now it depends on, you know, I personally believe that, you know, the higher power is the group thing. So I can row, which is my work, but the group can take the rudder. So I have to row, though. I'm responsible for that rowing, and I'm a pretty good rower. So I want to, because one of my greatest fears is Thoreau. I went to Walden Pond and I saw his plaque there, and he says, my greatest fear is that I had not lived, and I'm screwing up that quote, but that's my greatest fear, in that I didn't live to my full potential, man. So I'm rowing pretty good. And so these are spiritual principles. There's a saying in 12 step, and I know 12 step doesn't work for everybody. I still struggle with the God stuff, and I've had great sponsors in there who told me, you know, God stands for good, orderly direction. But there's a saying in AA and in the 12 steps, it says, I get loaded, or I get sick. We stay sober. We stay sane. right? So it's the we. It's being a part of, you know, and then also knowing what are my unique gifts? How do I contribute? You know, so these are just some of the spiritual principles that, again, when I can really overcomplicate things. And this was an interesting thing I learned from Dan Siegel too. He says there's a difference between complex and complicated. We're all complex. Human beings are complex, and I don't have to be complicated. So sometimes I can be complicated. So I have to go back to very simple things that I can remember, which are my little rituals, my daily meditation practice, my daily exercise, my daily routine of doing a gratitude journal, 10 things I'm grateful for. Like, these little things are spiritual principles, spiritual acts that keep me the attitude of gratitude. That's a spiritual foundation for me too. But what I find is that, you know, my friends who are, you know, follow the Quran, my friends who are Buddhists, my friends who are, Shinto from Japan. I mean, they all have these spiritual principles that they follow, and they're pretty similar to mine, and I just find that fascinating. So I don't know if I answered that question or not, but
you did.
I think it's important. So,
yeah, you did. And I like that you didn't make it complicated. You said some good key words, like the integrity and the gratitude and the openness to experience. And these are avenues of spiritual principle. That they are ways to, like, really ground it into some words defining ways that people can actually grab onto. Sometimes it gets a little too far out there, and it's like, oh, well, you know, but community is not so far out there. Community is a spiritual principle. And I like that. Roberto Assagioli is a founder of Psychosynthesis. He had this thing about being distinct and not separate. So we are distinct. We are the rower. We are the rower. We are distinct at rowing. But we are not separate from the rest of the boat, from the rest of the ship, the rudder, the water, even the everything else that we are. And we're putting ourselves into environments with people that are maybe not serving the interests that we have moving forward. I've definitely known that in my life. In the past, I've put myself into with groups of people that were not serving my best interests, and that allowed my boat to be steered in ways that I was not, you know, I was not happy about. It definitely put me into bad places. But I'm seeing that the universal principles is being willing to explore the mystery and receive the mystery, being open to it and receive it and integrate with it and be in integrity with it and be grateful for it and being in community with others that are doing some of the same rituals. I really love that. Yes, Deepak Chopra's right. What you're saying about Deepak Chopra is that, you know, ritual is in spiritual. And so now, what is our diet? What am I taking into my body? What are my practices of spiritual? What are my spiritual practices? What are my rituals that are feeding the diet of my body, mind, and soul? So important to have exercise in your life, to have your something that is written in the Bible. Is and this may or may not be written in the Bible, actually, but I had believed it to be so in the Bible, that an idle mind is the devil's workshop. So it's like my mind needs to be on things that are valuable to me. And then my soul is integral in how I'm, you know, being with others. And so, all of that is really beautiful. And I didn't articulate it as well as you did. Thank you so much, Eric. This is a really enlightening conversation. It really opens people's eyes. It opens my eyes around this extreme value, emphasis on the valuing of intimacy, how necessary that is, how without my intimacy with myself, I am going to be, you know, subjected to somebody else manning the rudder of my boat that I am rowing. And so that might emerge as social media, that might emerge as addiction to intercourse or addiction to substances. It's like now I have allowed, because I'm not learning and focusing on the intimacy with myself. Now I'm giving my agency away to these. I'm giving my responsibility away to these external things. And that's not where I'm going to find the intimacy that I need. So thank you so much. I really appreciate this conversation. Where can people go to continue to follow your work? I have a question for you. Will you be at the international or at the Transpersonal Psychology Conference, Euritas, in October?
I will not. I wanted to go to the Integral Conference in Europe. That's where I'm. My next, if I have the money to do that, I attend that one. But
write it off on your business.
That's true.
Write off on your therapy business if you're making income there. That's a write off.
Okay. Thank you for that.
The Transpersonal Psychology Conference in October is in Italy. I think the reason I'm encouraging that is what you're speaking about is a practical application of universal spiritual principles, which is it should be a foundation of transpersonal psychology. It's the practical application of these universal spiritual principles is really important. And when you ground it in the awareness of and the scientific, academic, scholarly, and as a clinician, as a therapist, looking at addiction and intimacy as the solution oriented around addiction, I think that's really grounding. It's really a necessary and valuable addition to the field. And I really appreciate having you as a part of the tribe.
Thank you. Thank you for that invite, and I will check it out. And thank you for having me on the show, Travis. And it was a delight in getting to know you. And if people want to contact me or find out more about me, they can go to my website, heartandsoulrecovery.org, heartandsoulrecovery.org. And that's where most of my stuff is. And thank you.
Awesome. Awesome. Heartandsoulrecovery.org. And you're in Asheville, North Carolina.
Correct.
Great. Awesome. So if there are other people in the area listening, what a great resource to have there. And thank you so much.
Thank you, Guy. Appreciate it. All right.